Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio. Today we're going to be talking about things that we've touched on peripherally in the past. Dust. You'll remember all sorts of people talking about dust, how it wanders from one place to another around the world, how it comes from various locations in Africa and surprisingly lands up in Texas. How does that work? And we're also will be talking about remote sensing. For example, if you've got a volcano and it's hidden by clouds, how would you know if it's going to explode or not, or whether it did? Well, remote sensing we'll put it down to. And we're going to be talking to a Dr. Santiago Gasso. He's from, and this gets complicated, he's actually officially with the University of Maryland, but his salary comes from NASA through various projects. NASA pays Maryland, Maryland pays Santiago. So it's complex. But Santiago, anyway, welcome very much to Science Studio.
Yeah, well, thank you. Thank you very much for hosting me here.
Before we get into remote sensing, dust, volcanoes, all that good stuff, let's learn a little bit about Santiago. Where did you grow up? When did you know you were going to be interested in being a scientist of some description?
Well, I was born in Argentina, and I grew up there. I went to school and primary school over there. And I became interested in science, but just marginally, because, for example, I would go to my grandfather's farm, which would be my summer holiday place. And because there was nothing to do at that time, no electricity, no entertainment, I would just go and wander through the fields and do my own little research about research, finding out what your grandfather was doing
with the farm. Was his cattle, or did he get into wine?
Yeah, it was cattle, but I mean, he had a little bit of extra money. He was a doctor.
Okay.
At the big city.
So he's a gentleman farmer.
What he wanted to have is a place where he could have his family during the weekends. And he would buy these rundown farms and hire someone to maintain it. And basically would strike a deal with this person where he would maintain the farm and make money out of it, as long as he kept the house and the grounds in good condition.
Right.
So, and that will be my summers spent in that farm. So, I mean, to me, it was more about trying to find things to do and, either chasing ants in the yard. I remember my grandfather would give me money for every ant's nest that would find, because so they would eat plants in the yard. So, and I would just become focused on finding ants, and same with bugs of all sorts. Originally I wanted to be a biologist, and then through high school, and I just was exposed to physics and math, chemistry, biology. It just became, to me, even though I did like biology and all those botany and zoology, it just became clear to me that I had to memorize too many things, whereas physics and math just came out more naturally. You just follow a few rules and things come out. So that's kind of set the stage of which direction I wanted to go.
So you went to university in Argentina?
Yes, I did a master's in physics in Argentina.
Where?
At the University of Buenos Aires, the main city.
That's the main university within Argentina?
Yeah, practically it's the major and the most prestigious and basically the only thing in town.
And then, like so many people from around the world, you went to graduate school in the U.S.
Correct.
How did you choose? You went to Washington, up in the northwest of the U.S., in Seattle.
Right, yeah.
Why?
Well, I mean... It's not that I got to choose, for example. It just was luck, I would say. It was basically, this was early 90s. Internet was just starting. There was my university in Buenos Aires. There was a single computer for the whole Department of Physics where you could send an email. And to me, trying to apply to a new university in the United States required some strategy. One approach was to choose the university you wanted to apply and send the application. But, you know, there's so many universities in the U.S. My approach was, let's contact all the Argentines that I knew I could get in touch with and try to get some insights on how I could get there. So I procured a list of 70 Argentine scientists, and I did my spam. I spammed them. This was early 90s. And, yeah, and it was numbers. You know, out of the 70, a few replied positively, and I chose to work with them to I got their advice on how to submit an application to university. I submitted to 3 universities. I only was accepted to 1, and it happened to be Seattle.
Okay. That's interesting. I suppose that's the way it works even today. We've got quite a few Chinese faculty members all over the U.S., and they seem to attract Chinese graduate students. It shows a good strategy, and, of course, it's the essence of networking.
Correct.
In some ways, it's a bit dangerous because it gets rise to the old boy network, you know, for the next stage, right? If you're looking for a faculty position, then you phone up all the Argentine faculty members and say, what's going on in your department? Any positions? Yeah. But, oh, well done anyway. So you got here and you got a PhD in physics. What did you study? What was your PhD topic?
Well, the degree actually was geophysics.
Okay, right.
That was the geophysics department at the University of Washington. And my degree was in, well, it was the atmospheric science orientation. And basically I worked in a group in the atmospheric science department where they had a plane. They would go out and measure different atmospheric properties. In this case, the group specialized on aerosols, which are is particles in suspension in the air, and smoke, dust, pollen are examples of aerosols. And they will have a plane go out there with instrumentation, sample the aerosol in situ through different probes in the wings of the plane. And my PhD was about analyzing those properties. And this was late 90s. This was the beginning of the remote sensing, big-time remote sensing era at NASA. And at that time, they were developing the computer algorithms to detect those aerosols from space. So my group was already interacting with NASA groups to analyze what they were expecting to see from the space and what was actually there as seen from the plane.
What was the big discovery? I mean, if you look back on that time and you say, well, this was the one piece of research that sort of had the biggest significance.
Well, let me think a little bit.
I shall tell the audience that you've got this wry smile on your face while you think about
this. Well, I mean, the point is that science is incremental.
Yes.
So I cannot specifically say, I did this and all this happened because I did this. But what I can definitely tell you is what I did contributed to the body of knowledge. My contribution was just a piece of it, and everybody else is using the body of knowledge to what we do right now to do detection from space. But for example, in my case, I was specifically interested in how these little particles capture water and they swell, they become bigger. How that phenomenon is seen from space. And actually from space, I mean...
So this is like in real time?
Yeah, you would take samples and, you know, expose the little particles to humidity and you measure how they grow. And we are talking...
So you do this in the laboratory too?
Yes.
And you create little cells, change humidity, look
Correct.
At the size variation.
Exactly.
And then apply that to what you were getting from...
Space.
The real place.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And basically I would take those properties we measure on the laboratory and then put that into a model that would generate the signal that would be seen by the satellite. And then we have the satellite flying. Yeah. So
did you have to have specific satellites? I mean, did you have a satellite which was quote-unquote ours? You know, University of Washington and so dedicated to your projects, or you just have to buy time on people's satellites?
Well, the way it was structured, no, we didn't have a specific satellite dedicated to university. Not then. Now okay. you have, but this is the mid-90s. What was happening then is NASA was already developing their own instrumentation to put in on satellites, and they were contracting out with universities to get all this information from the actual properties that are from the aerosols. So they were already partnering with external organizations to carry these comparisons.
Okay. And if I was your grandfather and I was to say, well, what was the point of that? What are we learning? Is that going to help us understand weather patterns, or is it going to be impacting the health of the nation? What was the rationale, if you like, for wanting to know this information in the first place, apart from just sheer new knowledge?
Oh, well, for example, we already knew by the 90s, we already had, NASA already had past satellite missions, and they already knew they could see big dust storms, they could see big fires, they could see pollution from cities, and they could see it very clearly. Now, the next stage is we can see it. I mean, how we can measure that? How to get actual numbers of what we're observing. And this is very important because this is the quantitative information that agencies and different official organizations need to make a regulatory decision to decide whether, okay, the level of pollution in this part is this high, so we need to implement these certain policies and measurements.
So from the PhD you went on, and now you're currently, as he pointed out earlier, nominally at the University of Maryland, but basically doing research contractually for NASA.
Correct.
So you're not an official NASA spokesperson. You're just a contractor for NASA.
Correct.
We'll get that out of the way. So anything that Santiago says is not officially NASA speaking. It's Santiago speaking. There are two areas that we were talking before the program that you're sort of interested in. One is this whole concept of remote sensing. And, for example, you were talking about one of your areas of interest is dust in cold places.
Correct.
And we'll come back to that. And the other is just observing the impact of volcanoes on clouds, mm-hmm. or looking through clouds at volcanoes by looking at the transformation of, I suppose, energy from the volcano to the cloud,
right.
and that does something. Tell us what that's all about.
Oh, well, that has to do with a phenomenon that is, in a way, related to pollution. I mean, you can interpret the emissions from a volcano as one type of pollution. There are lots of particles. There's water vapor. There is sulfur. So you can see this little puff of pollution coming out of the volcano. So this goes along with another phenomenon we are familiar with, which is the pollution coming from ships, smokestacks, and also smokestacks from power plants here.
Yeah.
You have the same type of phenomenon happening. You have a lot of pollution. In the case of marine environment, you have the ships that emit the pollution, and this pollution reaches the cloud base. There are lots of clouds in the ocean. And what is most important, that pollution interacts with the cloud and it changes the properties of the cloud. Some clouds become brighter. Some clouds acquire more droplets. And more importantly, because there are more droplets, there is more competition for water. So the droplets do not grow because there is not enough water available to grow. So what's the main effect? That those droplets, because they stay smaller, they don't fall. There is no gravity. So what is the main consequence? You have a cloud that in natural conditions would drain out because the droplets, now this cloud remains. So it stays longer. So this is called, it's a known effect that it's called the ship track effect, which is, you can see it from satellite very well. You see the clouds generated by the smokestacks and the ships.
You can see it moving along. So
right.
It's rather like looking at a contrail from an airplane.
Exactly. You
find out where the airplane was 10 minutes ago, at least.
Exactly.
Okay.
So the contrail would be right above 30 kilometers up. But here we are talking about the first 1,000 meters at the bottom of the atmosphere.
That's interesting, and I've never heard that before. We're going to take a break. You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell, and I'm here with Santiago Gasso from the University of Maryland, but a contractor for NASA. That's where he does most of his work. And we'll be back in one moment. Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Santiago Gasso from University of Maryland / NASA. Well, we were talking, Santiago, about this whole concept of smoke from moving boats, ships, and volcanoes creating a different sort of structure to the cloud. And therefore, we can, in fact, follow, in fact, the track of a boat, not by the smoke so much, but as from the cloud formation. I mean, that actually has almost got some military impact, right? That you can follow fleets.
I'm sure.
The Argentines would have loved to have had this when the Falklands Malvinas conflict was going on. Oh, here they come, just crossing the equator.
Yeah, I guess the technology was not available quite yet.
Right.
So
where does that lead? Okay, I mean, what you said, for example, two things you said which intrigued me. One is that in places where there are volcanoes, it's usually cloudy. I suppose, tell me why. I mean, England has no volcanoes, but it's always cloudy. I mean, why do you say that? Why was there a relationship in your mind between volcanoes and the degree of cloudiness?
Well, I mean, the motivation is it happens that a lot of volcanoes happen to be in places where it's very cloudy.
Well, I mean, yes, I understand that's a happenstance, but there's not necessarily a relationship. I mean, the volcanoes tend to be on where the crusts meet, right?
Correct,
And does that also mean that the weather follows those sorts of patterns too?
No. It's just a happenstance. There are places where you have lots of volcanoes and necessarily lots of clouds.
Okay, right.
So I'm just taking advantage of circumstance.
Okay, fine.
And okay.
So the other feature, you said that one of the impacts of volcanoes upon clouds in the neighborhood is to make them brighter. Now, what did you mean by brighter?
Right. This is a combination of two effects. One is that when pollution enters a regular cloud, regular clean cloud, starts to create more droplets. And the standard polluted cloud will have smaller droplets than a standard clean cloud. That has an optical impact. Big fat droplets tend to reflect less light, sunlight, than smaller, more numerous droplets. So what does it mean? That if there is a change in the way light is reflected, we can see it with a sensor. And that's the kind of, imagine a satellite has a detector which basically is a super sophisticated photo camera. It's measuring light in the visible light. So we are sensitive to that. So the connection here with volcanoes is, I was talking about ships, and they create these pollution clouds. The analogy is the same with a volcano. The only difference is that the cusp of the volcano is higher, closer to where the clouds are located. And when the top of the volcano is above the cloud deck, the emissions will not necessarily get in touch with the clouds. But I'm referring to those low altitude volcanoes.
So the brightness then, can you measure, or is there a correlation between size of the aerosols and the brightness?
Yes.
Have they got to a point where there's a graph that you can say, okay, there is.
Yes, there is. There is a correlation between the size of the droplet and the amount of light you measure from space.
All right. And does it have a name? Is that named after somebody who made the initial observation or discovery?
It's an accumulation of a body of research. There are several scientists. Each of them contributed to one aspect of this phenomenon.
Okay. All right. Enough of clouds and volcanoes and ships and steaming towards the Falklands or Malvinas. Let's change topics. The other thing that you mentioned before this program began, that you're interested in the concept of dust in cold places.
Correct.
So I'm thinking, you know, I'm going to go back to the refrigerator and sort of look in there. Is there anything special? What does that mean? What are you talking about? Polar regions, I suspect. But why? What's the big deal?
Well, the big deal, first, there is more dust in suspension around the world and in places that we don't think they should be. And here I'm referring to what I call high latitude places. Places that are poleward from 40 or 50 degrees north and south and usually are associated with glaciers. And what I'm referring to is silt that is coming from glaciers. Glaciers produce a lot of this flower-like silt. It's kind of a sand. It's very small. It can be easily suspended, particularly in this polar region near polar region. You have very strong winds, and they can be blown away very easily. And it's becoming it's a line of research that it has become more has received more attention lately because first we are monitoring our world better. We have satellites, but also we have surface networks. There are more humans near the poles, so people who can report about these effects. And then there are a number of applications by which we are starting to become interested in focusing on this dust.
Have you been down to Antarctic or to the Arctic?
No, the closest I've been to was 7 kilometers north of the Antarctica Peninsula.
Okay.
Which is, it's still pretty far south, yeah.
I remember many years ago I taught a course on environmental science, and one of the things that amazed me was reading some of the documentation done by the U.S. Army engineers where they were in the Antarctic and digging holes and seeing layers of material, okay? I mean, it wasn't dust per se, but it was just going down like a tree ring, except the deeper you go, the older was the level of material deposited. And then they were doing lead analysis to show that around the Industrial Revolution, mm-hmm. then lead started to grow and then whoosh, took off, in the industrial 20th century. Do you do any of that type of analysis? Is that something in your dust analyses, mm-hmm. for example? Do you look for what are the components of your dust? Is that something that you're interested in?
Yes, even though I'm not a chemist by training, but I'm interested particularly in the iron content, how much iron is in that dust. Because it happens near the poles, you have big oceans, and particularly in the Southern Ocean, you have a big water mass body around Antarctica. And what happens is marine geochemists go in and sample the water there, they find there are a lot of nutrients, like nitrogen, phosphorus, there, and they are not being utilized by the marine ecosystem, such as phytoplankton. And researchers wonder, how come there is so much food and it's not being consumed by the ecosystem? Well, it happens that there is one key nutrient that is missing. And that nutrient is iron.
Oh, I remember reading about this once. So there were people who were thinking, hey, let's just scatter iron sulfate or iron chloride over the oceans, and that will produce which we can then harvest.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And one side effect of that enhanced production or fertilization effect is that the phytoplankton would consume CO2. Carbon dioxide, and when it dies, it carries the carbon dioxide all the way to the bottom of the ocean. So that's called sequestration, and it's a way by which it's thought that the CO2 was removed from the atmosphere in geological times. And that's why, for example, the research carried out in Antarctica using ice cores, like the ones you describe, allow us to interpret whether there was a decrease in CO2 in past thousands of years, and check the temperatures at those times, and the records of dust deposition.
That's interesting. So is that concept that I just alluded to, of people sort of fertilizing now the oceans with iron, Is this still a serious idea? Because there's so many unexpected consequences.
Correct.
When
correct.
You do
and
things
it's
like
not.
That.
It's not. And actually, I think quite a bit of research has been shut down because the possible commercial applications of it and unintended consequence of that commercial applications. Not quite a number of research has been shut down. It's official applications of that concept because more research is needed to know what are the unintended consequences. So that has to do with the concept of geoengineering that has been on the media quite a bit. I mean, to me, what is more of appealing is trying to understand why some of the variations of temperatures across geological times has happened. And dust plays a very important role because when all these decreases in temperature during glaciations have happened, there have been increases in dust. And along with that, decreases in CO2. So the scientific question that intrigues me is whether the dust blown away during these geological times contributed to the decrease of CO2 by stimulating fertilization.
Okay. So this is an idea that needs to be evaluated.
Correct.
So this is the next 10 years of your scientific career.
Well, I mean, I'm a satellite guy, so you may want to ask the time scale.
But you work together. Okay, you're a satellite guy, quote unquote. But then you're talking to people all the time who are associated with the bigger picture.
Correct.
You are, after all, a contractor for NASA.
Right,
you do meet interesting people.
Oh yeah, it's a intellectual fascinating trip, just in exchanging with so many interesting people. But for example, one of the what I think is of interest to NASA, or at least in my opinion, is the fact that right now we have 40 to 50 years record of satellite images.
Yes.
So that's long enough that you can start to think almost in not geological times, but in a time frame where you can start to see phenomena that occurs at decades scales.
That's right. I mean, it's so important. One final question. Your grandfather, is he still alive?
No.
Did he know that you became a geophysicist and then worked with NASA?
No, really, no. No,
no.
He knew I was studying physics, but that's it.
That was it. Santiago Gasso, University of Maryland, mm-hmm. contractor with NASA, satellite imagery, remote sensing, volcanoes, dust in cold places. Mm-hmm. It's been a fascinating program. Thank you very much for being here.
Thanks to you.
And, of course, we have to thank Sam Cassiano for putting the program together. Thank you, the audience, for listening. And we will be back next week with yet another Science Studio. Adios.